from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Accompany men in the journey towards priesthood. That's what the Holy Father asked of the Church. The discernment of a vocation to the priesthood requires a great deal of thought, of prayer, and of study, and dioceses are always looking for ways to help men discern wisely. Today we talk about a new program taking hold to help men enter the seminary prudently and wisely. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host for Register Radio.
And I'm Matthew Bunsen, the Register Senior Editor.
And, you know, Matthew, we have also been looking at the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation over the last few days at the Register on ncregister.com. And last show, we looked at the Reformation for the whole entire show, but we didn't make it to the Catholic Reformation. So we're going to get to that later in the show. But first, we will be joined by Dr. Anthony Lillis, who is a founding member of St. John Vianney Theological Seminary in Denver, but who now serves in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles as the academic dean for St. John Seminary in Camarillo, California. Welcome to the show, Dr. Lillis.
Thank you, Jeanette. Obviously, I'm still waking up.
No worries. It's early. So we are talking about a wonderful program today that is just beginning. It's called High Calling, and it is to help men discern the priesthood. But this program is so interesting because it happens before they are in seminary. This is a response to something, as I said in the introduction, that the Holy Father has asked for. He asked for a propaedeutic year. What does that mean?
A propaedeutic year, it's an introductory phase of formation. So propaedeutic means introductory, and it comes before they begin their studies of philosophy or theology. And it's a time of preparation. It's interesting that you started our conversation with a reflection on the Reformation, and that you'll be talking about the Catholic counter-Reformation or the Catholic Reformation. And because the seminary that we have today was born out of that and was integral to addressing some of the problems that were going on in the Church at the time. A doctor of the Church, John of Avila, Juan de Avila, he wrote the Council Fathers and outlined the kind of seminary we have today. But 500 years ago compared to now, there's things that have happened in our society, and we've shifted from a basic Christian society to a very secular one. And it's in light of the secular one that John Paul II, over 30 years ago, first saw the need for this introductory formation, and Pope Francis said, yes, there's not only a need for it, we need to implement this introductory period now. And that's what this program, High Calling, attempts to do.
So what kind of issues are men facing, or even, I should say, seminary formators? What are you facing that this such a program is needed?
Well, in our culture as and society, just as the is, we can go any day to the news and we find stories about alienated young people who are doing destructive things to themselves or to others around them. They don't have the typical young person doesn't have the mentors and the support that once was there when we were a more Christian society. They are rebelling against, and this is a good thing, they're rebelling against the idea that somehow they're just a cog in the wheel and part of the machinery of society as we progress to who knows where. They want to assert their individuality. And then they come into a seminary where, you know, life is extremely regulated. And there are very high standards, and rather than radical individualism, we promote communion. And they're having a hard time transitioning from one world to the other, one way of being, which they've taken up just for their survival, to another way of being. And so young people, on the whole, need additional catechesis to enter into the communion of the church. And while that's true on the whole, it's especially true of young men who are looking into the priesthood, who want to come into a seminary.
Sure. You know, that makes me think, you know, our society is so materialistic that, you know, we have gotten used to living in one aspect of being a human person, and that's the material aspect. And we sort of forget about the spiritual. The spiritual lies dormant inside of us. And so it seems as though before they enter the seminary, they need to have to be in deeper touch with that spiritual side of themselves so that they can be fully human, fully alive as a human person. So it just seems like such a necessary part of becoming a holy priest is to start with this being fully human, so to speak.
You're referring to a quote by one of my favorite fathers, St. Irenaeus. He said, "The glory of God is man fully alive, and the life of man is the vision of God." And this propedeutic period, or this introductory period, our program introduces it, proposes it to the men during their application to seminary. So mm-hmm. even before they enter formal seminary, we have an online program that begins these kinds of discussions that open up a vision of God for them, but a vision that tries to address the whole of their humanity. How they relate on the internet, how they relate with peers in the workplace or at school, how they understand themselves, and how they understand what Christ is asking of them, learning to listen to his voice as he calls them out of one way of life into another.
Yeah, that integration of a fully formed person, of course, reflects what the bishops have called for with their formation program for seminaries of the great pillars of pastoral and human formation. What are some of the challenges that young men bring, especially you hit on a key word there on the internet, the dangers that we find that are posed to young men who are trying to grow up in this secularized society?
Yeah, it's the internet right now, because of where the entertainment industry is, and we have any number of stories about the destructiveness of that industry. It can do so much good, but it can also be very harmful. Unfortunately, young people as a whole, young men in particular, are being exposed to pornographic images even as early as the age of 8 to 9 years old. And they've grown up with an availability of this very destructive material from a very early age. And so this is one of the challenges, because, of course, the church asks men to be chaste for a full 2 years before they make application to seminary. And unless there's somebody there who has a background in psychology or sociology or understands what's going on the internet, but also has a prayer life to accompany them during this period, their ability to transition out of that and into a more basically Christian way of life, it's severely challenged. And that's been one of the things I've noted in my work as a seminary professor and as an academic dean now for over 20 years, is this has become a bigger and bigger problem every year. I think this propedeutic program and hopefully more programs like it are just what men need to help accompany them during this transition.
Well, you know, it's so unique about this program. I mean, we're talking about the negative effects of the internet, but this program is an online program. So there's some beautiful, wonderful effects of the internet and technology. So tell us a little bit more about the program itself and how it works.
Well, the program is divided up into 3-week modules, and I have different professors teaching different modules. Your own Dan Burke is teaching a module now on St. Teresa of Avila. I have a psychologist in this area, Danny Grimm, who's going to be working with the men in December on, we just talked about this last night, they're going to read together Wild at Heart. And anyway, they for 3 weeks, In 90-minute sessions, the professor accompanies them. The men journal, and the professor responds back to what they're journaling about. They have live interactions with each other. Although right now we're mainly focused on the L.A. area, it's interesting, even among the candidates for Los Angeles, the applicants for Los Angeles, one of our students is all the way out. He's a soldier stationed in Syria.
Wow.
And so he's taking the class and getting to know the other men who are entering seminary with him while he's, in battle fatigues, stationed out serving our country somewhere. And the camaraderie and the brotherhood and the mutual encouragement, it's irreplaceable. It's absolutely beautiful.
So far, what has the reception been like? I know this is a new program, but amongst those who are interested in seminary and also amongst other rectors or formators, what's the reception?
First, let me speak to the men who are participating in it right now. They are so excited. One of the most enthusiastic responses I received was from a man. He after the first module, he said, "Let me into seminary now. I can't wait." he was ready to enter immediately. And that kind of excitement and enthusiasm for the way of life, again, it's a gift, and it's what we want everyone to have. But among rectors and of seminaries and vocation directors, and bishops that I've had a chance to interact with, there is significant interest and enthusiasm for the program because they all are seeing the same thing that we've seen at the Avila Institute, that and my work here at the seminary, that this really is an area that we've got to address and we've got to get on top of today. If we don't, the men don't come into the formation as prepared as they could be, and they're not able to take advantage of the formation to be missionary disciples. Seminaries are exist to form men to be missionary disciples.
Absolutely.
So that as priests they can serve and accompany other missionary disciples. And everyone sees this as a great work, but how do we get there? And they're looking at a program like this, and they're saying maybe this is the opportunity that we've been waiting for.
Yes, and it sounds like a wonderful opportunity. We'll be following this. We have a reporter, Elizabeth Defner, who's been writing about this program, and soon it'll be online at ncregister.com. Dr. Lillis mentioned Dan Burke. Dan obviously is the executive director of the Register, but he also founded the Avila Institute, which is an organization that fosters spiritual life amongst laity, but now also amongst those who are looking at seminary. So we are grateful for that program and for Dan's work there as well. Dr. Lillis, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, Jeanette and Matthew, thank you so much for having me this morning, and thank you for the great work that you do.
God bless you.
When
we come back, Matthew and I are going to continue a conversation that we started last week talking about the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. This time, we look at the Catholic Reform. This is Register Radio on EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. More when we return.
Father Wade Menezes talks about the National Catholic Register.
As the National Catholic Register celebrates its 90th anniversary, I think that says a lot about the publication. It works. It's solidly Catholic. It presents the teachings of the Church, unabashedly so, and also guides its readers to be even more solidly Catholic themselves. One of the major effects that I think the Register has on its readers is that it elevates the intellect. Whether it be a faith item or a news item, it presents the news and the faith item in a very balanced way. One thing that the Register can never be accused of is being too far left or too far right. It is solidly Catholic, right in line with the Chair of Peter, and I think that says a lot about the Register.
For a 6-issue free trial of the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 6 free issue banner, or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues. And as you await your first issue, enjoy some of our online content.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back to Register Radio. This is Jeanette DeMello, joined by Matthew Bunsen. And for this segment, we are going to be talking about the Reformation, and it's just Matthew and me. We had a guest on last week, Mark Brumley, who did a wonderful job talking about the Reformation, how we should call the Reformation. It was in a piece called Reformation, Revolution, and Beyond by Mark Brumley on ncregister.com. And, you know, we didn't get to a very important part of the conversation about the Protestant Reformation, and that is the Catholic reform that was ongoing before and during and after the Protestant Reformation. So, Matthew, today I wanted to make sure that we were able to discuss the Catholic reform, and you wrote a piece on that exact topic.
Yeah, I did. We had that great conversation, as you were mentioning, with Mark Brumley last week about how do we even classify the mm-hmm. Protestant Reformation. Is it a Protestant revolt? Is it a Protestant revolution? Is it a Reformation? And we have the same question that can be asked about the Catholic reform. Is it the Catholic Reformation? Is it the Catholic reform? Or the other thing that we always hear is the Counter-Reformation, which mm-hmm. is a title that I never really agreed with. And I know a lot of Catholic scholars would also disagree that that's a title we should be using.
What is the preferred title? Is it Catholic reform, and why?
Yeah, well, if the idea of a counter-reformation is it plays into this image that we have of the Protestant Reformation sort of bursting out and finally pushing the church to deal with problems and crises and errors in among the faithful that had been going on for a long time, as though nothing had happened in the church prior to Martin Luther in 1517.
And that's not true. And that's what you wrote about in your piece on the Catholic Reformation. There was reform going on very early, recognizing some problems in the church. Let's talk first about what those problems were, because Martin Luther made a big deal about the problems, and that's because they were serious problems. But they weren't just lying there, you know, airing out for the world to see. There was activity to address these problems. So what were the problems that were already being addressed?
Yeah, well, we can start with some of the complaints that Martin Luther had. We had issues of simony, in other words, the selling of church goods and spiritual benefices. The prime example that Martin Luther really focused on was the erroneous selling of indulgences, focusing especially on Pope Julius II's otherwise noble effort to build a new St. Peter's, but it was funded in part because of some hucksters, such as mm-hmm. Johannes Tetzel, who were peddling indulgences, and this became a big cause célèbre in their time. But we also had what some people perceived was sort of a deteriorated, at least they would claim, a state of scholasticism, in other words, the study of St. Thomas Aquinas. We had as well questions about the loyalty, the faithfulness of priests to their vocations, a lot of the different questions. But what we can find is that every one of those issues that was raised by Martin Luther was already percolating in the form of reform in some fashion or another. If we look, for example, at the question of the clergy, we already had in places like Spain and elsewhere a number of bishops and archbishops who were pushing for the reform of the clergy, sort of anticipating the work of the Council of Trent, as we just heard from Dr. Lillis, that established this whole seminary reform. That the model that we have today was largely a product of those reformers of the early 16th century that finally galvanized with the Council of Trent. So we had all sorts of other different things percolating, as I was saying, to use that word again, in the church long before Luther.
You know, one of the things that you wrote about in your piece is titled Catholic Reform Began Before Martin Luther, and this is on ncregister.com. One of the types of reform you wrote about was Christian humanism. And mm-hmm. I've been reading a lot about the Reformation, and quite excitedly so. So my husband and I have talked about what I've been reading, and I was talking to him about humanism. And of course, he said, but isn't that the word that people use now to really talk about atheism? You know, it's a type of humanism. So what is this Christian humanism? Well, this is something that started in, as a response to some of the problems in the church. So exactly what is Christian humanism?
Right. Well, when we're talking about Christian humanism, the easiest way to describe it is to attach it to some of the people that we think were the great Christian humanists. Thomas More, for example, in England, who authored a book called Utopia, in which he was trying, through a book like that and his other writings, to revive the authentic study of the human person in made in the image and likeness of God, and therefore worth studying. But the church has always also always been fascinated, interested, and helped to guide the great intellectual and artistic endeavors of humanity. And so Christian humanism is literally, as the Latin would say, the studia humanitatis. It's the study of humanity itself, which is such an interesting topic. And then you can apply that within sort of that lens or through the lens of the Christian faith so that you see someone, as John Paul II did, for example, made in the image and likeness of God, but you can also find Christ there. And that the church then, as sponsor of art, of literature, of philosophy, brings this rich history of knowledge and awareness of the human person to the study of humanity itself.
You know, it's so interesting. You said you can find Christ there in this humanism, and that's precisely what makes it different from the sort of atheistic humanism that we see embraced often today. So this is a beautiful form of humanism, the Christian humanism. And one of the things that makes it so different from what happened with some of the Protestant sects that grew out of the Reformation is that it did embrace art. It did embrace culture in a way that was still had a sensualness to it in a good way. They didn't withdraw from the sights and the sounds that Catholicism has, the way that many Protestant sects did withdraw from that with you know, the banishing of images and sort of the whitewashing of the churches. In fact, we have a piece coming out about this, and you helped to assign this commentary.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's just going to look at the question of art and the Catholic Reform. Because one of the amazing things that came out of the Catholic Reformation was this explosion of art and architecture and music. We think, for example, anyone who goes to Rome, you see those beautiful colonnades. I know you live there,
right,
Jeanette. The colonnades in front of the Vatican, of St. Peter's Basilica, that stretch out from St. Peter's Square. And this was, in the view of the great architect, Gian Lorenzo Bernini, who conceived this, the church revived, reaching out to the world with her arms to embrace the whole of humanity, the whole of the globe. And that's exactly what happened with the immense missionary enterprise that followed the Catholic Reform.
So one of the other pillars of this Catholic Reform were the saints and those who acted in very vivid ways to revive the spiritual life of the church. Who were they?
Yeah, well, the list is almost endless in this. Just in the 16th century. We think of some of the great reformers of Teresa of Avila, John of the Cross. We can also mention Dr. Lillis in the previous segment mentioned one of the newest doctors of the church, and that's John of Avila, who was himself a spiritual guide to Teresa of Avila, John of the Cross, and Francis Borgia, to name a few. We had as well Ignatius Loyola. The list itself then stretches into the 17th century. So you end up with saints like Francis de Sales and John Vianney, subsequently. You also had some of the other great figures who helped bring about a spiritual renewal in the church, such as Vincent de Paul, who was really helping to focus the attention of the faithful to the poor, to the forgotten. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't this, as we often hear, this triumphalism that surrounded the Catholic Reform, but there was also a re-recognition of the dignity of the human person. We go back to Christian humanism and that focus on the poor and the forgotten. In other words, the importance of works.
Absolutely, and that gets down into some of the substance of Martin Luther's theology that grew out of the Reformation. I did want to mention, though, that the Augustine Institute, someone that we cover often, an organization that we cover often at the Register, has a wonderful DVD set out on the true reformers, that is, the saints who were working to reform the church right around the time of the Protestant Reformation. Matthew, we just have a couple minutes left, and I think I want to end on the question of what must we leave this 500th anniversary of the Reformation with? What should Catholics know and embrace, I guess, prayerfully at this particular moment in history?
Well, I would argue that we have to recognize that the tragedy of the Protestant Revolt, the Protestant Reformation, that it shattered Christianity, and we're still trying to put things back together again. And it also forces us to focus very intently on that close union between authentic reform and authentic spiritual reform. We have to become holier ourselves if we're going to be real heralds and carriers of reform in our own lives and then in the church and throughout the world. So you have to have that pairing of prayer and the sacraments and a recognition of the authority of the church, along with our own desire to bring institutional reform. They have to go together, and we have to recognize that authority and the right of the church to guide us.
This has been a great conversation about the Reformation, and I'm so grateful that we've been able to spend so much time. Before we end, I just want to go through a list of the articles that we've had at NC Register on the Protestant Reformation and the Catholic Reform. The one that we've been talking about here with Matthew is Catholic Reform Began Before Martin Luther. We also had Reformation, Revolution, and Beyond. We had a piece by Stephen Beale called Fractured Faith, The Reformation at 500. And, of course, we also had one on England, several on the Catholic Reformation in England, Catholic England on the Eve of Destruction. This has been a wonderful opportunity for the Register to really get into the details of the reform, and I sure hope that you're able to enter into this important time of reflection. Thank you so much for joining us on Register Radio. Please, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out National Catholic Register at ncregister.com. Thank you for joining us on Register Radio here on EWTN. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless you.